The lessons I learned from rock and roll are not exclusive to music, because they involved mistakes, opportunities, preparing for success. It's too easy for people to give up. You know, the nerdy part of me feels like I'm on a mission to keep the legacy alive of some of the greatest artists that ever lived, because it takes a lot more than talent. It takes things like...
What do David Bowie, U2, and Matchbox 20 all have in common? Our guest today has worked with all these iconic bands and many more, and he's here to share with us today the life lessons he's learned from decades in the music industry that will translate directly into success when it comes to business and leadership. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we believe that great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby, two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 30 years. In a moment, I'll be joined by Tony Michaelides, a music industry veteran, legend in his own right, author and podcast host. I'll be asking Tony to share his amazing insights and stories around why the biggest stars are the easiest to work with, always be on the lookout for emerging talent, and his unforgettable moment of seeing U2 perform in front of just 11 people back in the day in a small pub.
Can you tell us a great Bowie story?
I'll tell you the beginnings of it. I mean, I saw David Bowie split up the Spiders from Mars in front of me as an 18-year-old, right? And I was really pissed off with him because it was like, you know, you can't do this. Where's my next David Bowie record going to come from? And I drove home for 4 hours in the pouring rain, really annoyed, you know, because it was like, you know, I was a fan. I was, you know, like 18 years of age. And then 30 years later, I'm sitting around having my dinner with him, arranging all his radio and TV. And that doesn't happen to a kid from the north of England. And to be honest, I mean, I'm 71 now. I'm not ashamed of it. But I don't think the gratitude sets in until the roller coaster ends. And I learned as much from David Bowie as I learned from anyone. I even had on my own podcast, which you know about, Dem, but I'll tell everybody else, called Moments That Rock, where I delve into industry insiders and artists and have them share their moments that rock. And I got Susie Ronson on, who was married to Mick Ronson, Bowie's guitar player in The Spiders from Mars. And she wasn't. She met him through The Spiders from Mars. But she'd come up with great stories like David Bowie's mother used to go in. She didn't own the salon. She was just a hairdresser, like 19, in a salon. She was cutting her hair. And Bowie's mother was coming in telling about her son. And he'd only had one hit, Space Oddity. And then Angie Bowie, who was married to at the time, came in. And she
I read her book.
Yeah, she got chit-chatting with him. And she basically, to cut a long story short, brought her in. She was the only girl on the road with 18 guys, and it was around Ziggy. But when I bring people onto my podcast, it's like, it's totally self-indulgent, because I told you this, it's like, I enjoy the stories, why wouldn't other people? But the thing is, get a load of this. So we all know what Bowie in the 70s looked like, right? And the thing is that she was the person that came in on the road and said to him, you'd look pretty good with red hair, you know. So you look at the whole image and everything, and this 19-year-old girl in her hairdressers came on the road and put all that together. And that's why she met Mick Ronson and stuff. But it was amazing, the story she was telling me, because Bowie split up the Spiders from Mars on stage at the Hammersmith Odeon in London, and the band didn't even know. And it was like he dropped, you know, it's not only the last night of the tour, it's the last night we'll ever do. And it's like, and she was telling me about how he didn't have anything to do with the band, and she thought would have helped with Mick. And that wasn't David Bowie that I worked with. But the thing is, Damon, that back in those days, I mean, David Bowie became like a drug addict, you know. He was an addict. But the thing is, when you look at that what we call the 27 Club, you know, like Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, you know, Hendrix, even Kurt Cobain, you know, when the success comes in, but they overindulge on anything. We wouldn't be talking about David Bowie now if he'd have been dead at 27. Not only was he smart enough to, well, I say smart enough now because I'm old enough to understand why he did it, but he split the band up because he was always thinking of the next phase in his career. So I'm done with this, much as you love it. You know, I'm out of this. I'm moving on to the next, you know, David Bowie era. He was also smart enough to kill off his drug addiction. Otherwise, like I say, he wouldn't be the well, for me, he's arguably the most innovative artist of our generation. And he always will be. And, we're talking about, like, what is it, 8 years or something? I can't remember, 17, 18. Anyway, David Bowie, in many ways, brings the best out in me. I wrote an article that USA Today printed on the second anniversary of his death. And, you know, I'm finger typing like this, you know, and I'm not preparing anything, but on a creative level, it brings the best out in you. My first paragraph was, there really is a star man. He did come and meet me and he did blow my mind. You know, but it's so personal, but it's so like, and then I tell stories about, you know, one of the things that I'll never forget is, if you want me to talk a little longer about Bowie, edit it out if you don't.
I have one question. What was your very first meeting like with Bowie?
Well, it's funny actually, because I got a phone call from a company called Lipsy Mead in London from a girl called Roxy Mead, one of the directors, and they took care of Bowie's publicity down south in London with the management. And she phoned me up literally, you know, the start of the Earthling tour, 1997. And she said, Tony, we can't get out on the road. We've got so many things going on. Would you go out on the road to David Bowie and arrange all his, you know, radio and TV? And it's like, I can't believe what I'm hearing, phone conversation. And she says, hello, you know, are you that? Yeah, right. And she said, well, listen, David likes to meet everybody he works with. So can you go to the Manchester Academy tomorrow? I'll give you the name of the tour manager. He'll introduce you to David because, like I said, he likes to meet everybody he works with. And then there's this pause and she said, just do that and we can, because, you know, and then we can get you out there and get everything. You can liaise with us with what's happening. And she says, and then we'll talk about money later. So there's this pause. I go, you want me to work with David Bowie? She said, yes. I said, and you're going to pay me? Like I needed paying to work with David Bowie. So I went out and arranged all his radio and TV. Now, who doesn't want to interview David Bowie or write about him? It's not a hard thing to do. But every day he liked you to go out and buy the papers, not for his ego, but he wanted to think what people... He was in a drum and bass period, you know, so people wanted to know... He wanted to know what they thought of this part of his career. But the other thing is I would sit down with him every night and run through everything that was going on. And there was this one instance where he was in what we call in the Midlands in the UK, which is like the middle of the country, Birmingham. And he did a gig at this. It was a small, there were small venues in as much as they weren't arenas. It was like 1,000-seater tours, you know, universities and things where you can actually see the guy, which was amazing. And then he was doing festivals in Europe. I mean, he wasn't sure of cash, but it was just what he wanted to do. So I sit down one night with him and he said, what's happening, Tony? I said, well, you know, there's this guy at the BBC. Yeah, he's a big fan, David. He's got all your records, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, there's ITV, which is the commercial channel in the UK. And I hastened to add that my music industry years were in the UK. And I said, there's this guy from the ITV, the commercial station. And, you know, I said, listen, you're a famous guy. You know, everybody's sitting around having their dinner. They show a clip of the video and they interview you. The gig's sold out. It doesn't matter. Whatever you want to do, it's entirely up to you. And he said, well, what do you think, Tony? And I said, well, to be honest, David, it's entirely up to you. So he repeated himself, no, what do you think? And I said, well, to be honest, David, if I was going to do one, I'd do the guy from the BBC because he's a huge fan. And pardon me if I burst into tears, but he turns around and goes, well, if you think I should do it, Tony, I'll do it. I swear to God. I mean, his wife, Iman, was on the road then, so I left him to his downtime. So I walked away from, you know, tell him what was happening. And I walked into the corridor and I was clenching my fist. I thought, I don't believe this. David Bowie has agreed to do something on my recommendation. And I'm talking about it now, like 2017, 25 years later, I'm still talking about it. And another thing, just to finish the Bowie saga off about that tour, was one of the jobs I had to do was every night you had the photographers were in the orchestra pit. And they can only do the first three numbers, then you have to sling them out. So I'm in there at the orchestra pit, and they're doing all the slips. And every night on that tour, David Bowie would walk out with like a white linen shirt, white satin trousers, barefoot, with a white spotlight on him, looking like David Bowie, with an acoustic guitar, and play a song from Hunky Dory or Ziggy Stardust. And I swear to God, I was like this. It was almost like, if you'd have told me that, at 15, I collapsed and I would have never made it to this age, you know. And it was like a private show. And he'd go into like 5 years or, you know, some of those classic tracks on those albums. It was phenomenal. And all the photographers in my later catch it because he'd go like this. You just look to the side of the door, get the photo shots. It was amazing.
How did you get into the music business?
Well, it's funny you say that. Now, it wasn't like, you know, I know you have like business guys and gals listening to this, but it wasn't that I wasn't ambitious. It was just that they had a thing in the UK called Further Education College, which was perfect for people like me who were done with school but not quite ready for work. But I needed a job to buy records and go to gigs. It was that simple. So I got a job, and it was a crap job. I get an every day, and, you know, the office manager used to come in, sit behind his glass partition, shut the door, and he would never go around the room and talk to his staff or anything. And he used to send his PA out to buy flowers for the and a wife's anniversary and all that and everything, you know, and somebody to go and wash his car. And I'm looking at it, and I was like 17, and I thought, there was nothing in Spain. I didn't want to be in when I grew up, you know. So, like, I went, I was going home one day, and the other thing was the office. I had one guy coming in. He'd been there 7 years, and from the moment he came in on a Monday morning, he kept talking about he couldn't wait till Friday when he could get in the pub with his mates. I'm thinking, oh, my God, get a life. Go and get a job, you know. So anyway, I'm going home one day, and this was really weird. I bought a copy of the Manchester Evening News, which is the local paper, you know, and I don't usually buy it. And if I do buy it, I buy it to see the gigs that are happening or to the records that review. And for some unknown reason, I went to the classified ads and I saw a job that was for Transatlantic Records as a sales rep. Well, I'd never heard of Transatlantic Records. I was buying Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, and that I was into progressive rock, as they called it back then. We're talking like, you know, early 70s.
Some of the best time ever for music.
Oh, amazing. So anyway, I go into the local HMV shop and I'm rifling through the records, the Transatlantic section, because I knew it was folk and jazz. And I pick out all these records by nobody I've ever heard of. And now I've heard of them because the jazz side was people like McCoy Tyner and Wayne Shorter and Miles Davis. I didn't know about them then. I was a kid. So anyway, so I've told this story a lot, but so I got the train home and I forgot about it, but that's rubbish. I didn't forget about it. I went home thinking about it. I walked home from the railway station thinking about it. I went to bed thinking about it. And I woke up thinking about it. And I went to work and I'm gazing out the window. So I applied for it. Now, like I said, you know, I wasn't happy in my job, but I knew I had to work to pay the rent and stuff like that. I mean, I was staying at home at the time. But I thought, you know, I don't have a job in the music business. If I don't get it, I still don't have a job in the music business. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And the 70s were kind of a crazy era, like Island Records and labels like that would employ girls on reception, looked like they could have been on a rupture music sleeve, you know. So it was all very glam and this and that. And the girl in the office had accidentally put it in the Manchester Evening News. It should have been in Music Week, which is the equivalent of Billboard. Should have been in a trade paper. But, you know, I always say about it, all my friends who went to the same gigs and bought the same records could have all applied for that job. But, and I'm not being disrespectful, like, they got proper jobs. They worked in banks, insurance, lawyers, you know. And I got a job that was an extension of my hobby. And I started selling records at the back of a van for £25 a week. And I absolutely loved it. And the thing is, even at that age, I went out every single day to prove to that guy it was the best decision I ever made, giving me a job. It was a job that I never expected, that would never let go. And then after 2 years of that, I went to ABC Records, which had opened a British division called Anchor. And it had a band called Ace, but it had Steely Dan, it had Don Williams, a lot of, you know, Freddie Fender, a lot of country records. I did that for a couple of years. And then a friend of mine who, I mean, the great thing about it was my record collection really expanded because all the people who worked in record stores back then were all music fans. So they'd have stuff waiting for me to listen to, you know, oh, this is great. And I'd take this and give them a couple of amps and buy them from it and stuff. Shouldn't have done that, you know, swapping back. But I did that. They're attacking me now. So it was just incredible time. And a friend of mine, a guy sharing a place with her, was the Island Records regional promotion guy, and he got a DUI in the UK. So obviously he couldn't go and do his job, and the label were very, you know, very loyal. They transferred him to London. He worked at Island Music where he could come in on the tube and he didn't have to have a car. So there was a vacancy. So she said to me, you should apply for the Island job. And I went, you know, and I was so dumb. I was thinking, well, you know, do I have to laugh at DJ's jokes and things like that to get my record played? That'd be stupid, right? So eventually I relented and went down. And it's so funny because I went down I used to have this great poster, and it's one of my favorites. And it's just the island logo. And in small letters at the top, it says, if you don't promote, a terrible thing happens. And then in the middle, it says nothing, you know, and it was my prized possession. And I went to the island office, and honestly, Damon, it was amazing. They had this huge white ball that ran and rungs the wall. And when anything was happening with any artist, there was a ladder. They'd climb up it and put, like, you know, Steve Winwood, you know, on these playlists and things. So anybody was on the phone in sales, marketing, promotion could all look up at a moment and see anything that was happening with any one of those artists instead of piles of notepads. And the first band I worked with was a band called Eddie and the Hot Rods, which had a top three single in the UK. They were kids. They were in the teenagers, you know, 18, 19. And my first initiation into the promotion, when I agreed to take the job, was this guy took me down to a program called Revolver TV in Birmingham, where they had a network TV, to introduce me. And I walked in, right, with this guy, and across the other side of the room is the bass player slumped in his chair like this, you know. Yeah. And he had a beer bottle.
A couple too many cocktails.
It's like 11 o'clock in the morning, you know. It's,
anyways.
So he says, like, oh, this is telling me to be taken over from me, you know. So he picked this bottle up. He flew across the room and going like that. And it smashed on the wall behind me. I thought, oh, my God, did I really sign up for this?
It's rock and roll, Tony.
It's rock and roll. But, you know, the thing is, they didn't really have any more hit records. There was a time I got pissed off with them because, you know, I took the lead singer into, you know, I mean, you go to the gigs and you're on expense account. So, you know, your meals and your beer and everything's paid for by the record company. But I wasn't a sub scabby, but running around feeding them. And I even took the singer to a shop. He wanted some shoes and he wanted me to go up to the girl behind the counter and give him his room number. I was like, you know, anyway, one night, and I'd only been doing it like 2 or 3 months. And like, they're coming on stage. I walk up to him and we call it like Manx style, Manchester, you know, a bit of swagger. And I walk up to him, I look at him. I say, you have turned into a complete asshole. As of now, I will be.
What do you say about that?
He changed like that.
Interesting.
No more of that push force. But it was like, it was an in your face moment. I'm quite proud that I did it. You know, because I'm not taking stuff like that from, you know, I want to do a job which is helping them with their career. And this is a trait that I've always had. You know, I always found that the biggest artists are the easiest to work with because they know it's not all about them. I mean, Bowie's the prime example, you know. It's the closest thing I've come to royalty. I mean, I'm not going to get knighted, so working with Bowie was the closest thing that'll ever happen to me. And in the fact that I get the opportunity, which I'm pleased in things like this, to talk about a guy, because I, you know, the nerdy part of me feels like I'm on a mission to help keep the legacy alive of some of the greatest artists that ever lived.
Part of what you're doing is, you know, is keeping their legends and their stories alive. You know, I mean. It's I never got an opportunity to see Bowie live, which I wish I would have, but I did earlier this year, maybe even last year it was. I went to the Sphere and I saw U2 play, one of the most iconic bands of all time. And Tony, share with our listeners, you were there from the very beginning with U2.
Well, the thing is, listen, David Bowie would have been fine without me. He was famous. He was a superstar when I came on board. I promoted his records for about 10 years, but he never really did regional interviews. It was mailing them out. And there were periods when they weren't going onto playlists, so they were getting onto specialist shows and stuff. So he would have been fine without me. But I did feel that I played a part with U2 because I kind of, to quote my own words, I grew up learning my trade as they were learning theirs. Because I've always been a great advocate of emerging talent, and I'm kind of involved in that area now, which if we get onto later, I'll explain. But the thing is, U2 is like Coca-Cola. It's like a global brand now. But people don't understand that U2 were like emerging talent. It took me a year to get them on the radio. And I took them into every little radio station, getting an interview that would go out at like midnight on a Tuesday. We're not talking about big stations. Anywhere you could get it, because there were a lot of specialist radio shows, which I always say that was my favorite topic, for want of a better word, artist development, working, you know, because I'm a great believer in, you know, bands playing their dues. They would go and they would play a gig and then they would all get four in the back of a van with the equipment there, the tour manager driving to sleep four in a room or if they were lucky, get two rooms, and have me getting them up to take them into interviews, and then they go to sound check, and then they get in and they meet the fans after the gig. And the first time I saw U2 was they were third on the bill at University Gig in Manchester. And I went with a guy who was my lodger, who happened to be the local DJ. And, you know, Bono was like, his voice was a bit up and down. You know, Adam couldn't play the bass to save his neck. You know, Larry was a solid drummer. The Edge was good. But, you know, he walked on and, you know, he walked in the microphone. Where you two? And in those days, we're talking, I know the date, the 31st of May, 1980, you know, they were just signed to Island Records. And I'd actually lost my job at Island. And I worked there from 78 to 18. And I was one of five people on regional promotion. And they were having cash flow problems. And the first people to lose their jobs are the people on the road. So hard as it was for them, they didn't really want to get rid of us. I mean, I got a job 20 minutes later working with Charisma for like an extra $2,000 a year. And they had Genesis and Peter Gabriel. So all of a sudden, they, apart from Bob Marley, they were the biggest bands that I had the opportunity to work and learn from. But then after that, there wasn't much on the catalogue. So I had I'd seen U2, and then I had the audacity to phone Island Records back up and offer to do five people's job for one person's wage, which was quite attractive. And it was because of that gig. Because when they came on stage, I ended up seeing them four times that week. I saw them play to 11 people in a pub, and four of those people came with me. They came out, Damon, like they were playing to a stadium. And that engagement, you know, where they're just like, you know, we're going to leave and you're going to know our name and who we are. Hey, we're you two. This is a song called And Away They Go, you know. And it wasn't like the greatest band on earth, but there was a certain something. And they came out to meet every single person that wanted to meet him and sign, you know, what the single that they had out or something. And when you think of it now, I always think of, you know, what you want to call it, interpersonal skills or whatever. It's kind of like learning who your fans are. Could you imagine, with this is well before social media, could you imagine Bono at that stage getting into a van and traveling to the gig and getting on social media and making like 10 fans in Japan? Because they all tell their friend, oh, I met this guy from a singer, it's really good. And they do, they're your PR department, and then wake up in the morning, they've got 100 fans. They didn't have any of that. They built all their fan base from playing live, which is old school.
What I'm hearing you say too, though, is that you two, I mean, they were nothing. They're a third on the bill at a pub. But they came out, and I think that this is a good parallel if you want to expand on it. For the business world, they came out there, didn't feel like they were owed anything. And even where they were at, they gave it all, right? You know, and I think that that's so important from a business perspective as well, is that you gotta earn your stripes. You gotta work your way up. And some of the most talented people, whether it's salespeople or facilitators or whatever it is, you know, they're always looking to hone their game. They're always looking to get better.
Absolutely. And even in the music thing, there's a lot of people that have become really famous producers over the years. They started making cups of tea in the studio, you know, just to get in and work their way up. And I agree, it's hard work and it's dedication. And the other thing is, there's always got to be that curiosity factor, you know, because Bono and the rest of the band, I mean, when they were in town, they would go into the local record stores and find the people that were selling the records and mingle around and see if people were, you know, interested in talking to people. And they had that curiosity about them, where Bono wanted to know like all the ins and outs of the business. You know, when he went down, he'd even go to the plant where the records were and meet the people that were pulling the records out to get them mailed out.
How do you think that impacted their success was that curiosity that we're talking about right here?
Well, it's also blood, sweat and tears, not in the naming of the band, but the fact of the matter is, they would never complain about anything because, you know, on the one hand, it's like, you wanted to do this, get on with it. You know, it's not going to be a 9-to-5 job because you're coming on at night, you sound check, you're doing interviews in the day. So it can be very demanding and it can wear people out. And a lot of them go into drugs and drink and stuff like that. It's almost like a release. But the thing is, with a band like that, I mean, it's funny because this, to quote my own, you know, words over the years, it's like they worked their asses off. They went to America, like, you know, they didn't outstay the 180 days they were allowed in. They'd go in, they'd do tours, like, you know, 5 out of 7 nights, you know, right across the country. Then they come back and they tour England, they tour Europe, Then they go back and do some more in America. And they played every single town. And the first time, you know, you get 50 people there. Then all of a sudden you get 100. Then you get 200, 500, 1,000. And now you look at them now and you saw them at the Sphere. And the interesting thing that I find out about, and I use this in the talks that I do, because my brands, like I mentioned to you, are moments of rock and lessons learned from rock and roll. And the lessons that I learned from rock and roll are not exclusive to music, because they involved mistakes, opportunities, preparing for success. You know, even since the pandemic, resilience, you know, it's too easy for people to give up. And I find that the thing with U2 was, I mean, for instance, everybody knows about, well, of a certain age, we'll know about Live Aid. That was a time when U2 had just made a record with Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno. So they were, even to the extent that they had a producer that gave them a particular drum and guitar sound. And they went and decided to work with Brian Eno, who'd made records called Music for Airports. And it was ambient music, right? And Chris Blackwell had signed Brian Eno to Island Records. And he even said to the band he didn't think it was a good idea. But he had so much respect for him that he left him to do it. And that was a turning point in their career, the Unforgettable Fire. So when they got Live Aid, we'd had an album called Red Rocks after the Red Rocks thing, which was a cheap mid-price album. And that had charted and things. And then all of a sudden, they got an opportunity to do Live Aid, which was huge. You know, it was a global, there was an audience of 1.4 billion people. We're not talking about a few thousand listening to radio. We're talking about serious international global exposure. And they came on, and even Queen, everybody had 20 minutes. So if you were over 20 minutes, the plug was pulled. So they came on and they did Sunday Bloody Sunday, I think, and I can't remember the other. And then they did a track called Bad. And they were going to do Pride because we just got it on the radio, right? So in the middle of Bad, Bono decides to do a walkabout. So he steps down from the stage that is up here to like there where the security people are to keep the fans away, you know. And the band can't even see him. So they're like this. Where's he gone? You know. So that Bad ended up as 7 minutes. He pulls a girl out from the crowd. And he starts slow dancing with it. Nobody can see this apart from the crowd and the people on TV. And then they're still playing away. And this 5 minute number is 7.5 minutes. And then it's like, done, you're off. And Bono walks up back onto the stage with his, and even they didn't have radio mics. The tour manager had to follow him with a microphone, you know, with the lead, so he wouldn't fall over. Anyway, people don't know this, unless they've heard me blabber on about it. But the thing is, after that, it came off and the band wouldn't talk to him. They were furious. Paul McGuinness, the manager, was, right? Nobody spoke to him. Bono was embarrassed. He went off to stay with a friend in the south of Ireland, in Southern Ireland, and Paul McGuinness went to stay with a friend out in Paris. And it was, the atmosphere was electric for all the wrong reasons, because here was an opportunity to showcase to 1.4 billion people a record that had just started to get going, Pride. Paul McGuinness goes out the following morning, buys a copy of La Parisienne, and the front cover is how Freddie Mercury and U2 stole the show. And that week, their four albums went into the top 10.
That's an amazing, amazing story.
I mean, that could have, we wouldn't be talking about him if they'd have actually sacked him. But before they had a chance to even contemplate doing the dirty and saying, you're done, we can't have you behaving like this. I mean, even before that, Bono would, he can't do it now because the, you know, it's dangerous, but he would climb up PA stacks onto the balcony and sing vocals stood on a chair in the balcony, and everybody's going like, and you can see it on Live Aid, you know, you can see the, you know, the you know, climbing up the PA and everything like that. But he was like lost in the moment. But that became such an emotional attachment for the fans, seeing that intimacy with that girl, and then he puts her back into the crowd. And that was what, you know, no record company in a way could have told him, hey, you need to screw up today, so you know, we'll go somewhere with this. And that then led into the Joshua Tree, and the rest is history. And the reason that U2 are an important part of my set when I go out and talk to corporate companies and things like that, Damon, is the fact that, like most people that are in corporate America, corporate England, corporate anywhere, U2 have always been famous. They can't relate to a fact when they were nothing. I have photos on my website and things of them having a barbecue at my house, you know. And they would come round and then like, you know, I would play him Van Morrison and Bob Dylan records. So I even kind of, in a way, turned them on to my record collection because I had a few years on them. And it's funny now because I look at them now and they're just about the age to get their bus pass now and things, you know. You don't think everybody else is growing up as you are. But yeah, I mean, I did play a part in, I got them their first national TV and I got them their first national radio session outside of their native island. So I didn't break them. You know, it was a combination of press and dedicated people. But to be honest, there weren't that many people at the record label at the time that could have the vision. And we're not always right. Sometimes we have a good feeling about bands, but there was something about that band that I shared with my lodger who was a DJ. And the press department at Island were phenomenal.
Some of what I hear you saying, which I think is true for sports, business, music, is that not only did U2 and Bowie, they have the talent, but they had the passion and they had the work ethic to go along with it. There must have been several times though throughout your illustrious career where you saw bands who had the talent, but they just didn't have they just never amounted to anything because they didn't have the work ethic to go alongside it.
Well, I'll give you a couple of quotes. Like, one is from Doc McGee, who used to manage, like...
Guns N' Roses, right? Yes.
Guns N' Roses, Bon Jovi, Motley Crue. We're not talking about easy management, right?
Now you're talking about my language. Those were all my favorite bands.
You'll love this quote. He said, 90% of rock stars have less than a high school education. They wave their hand in one direction and 30,000 people wave their hand in the same direction and they feel power. And then they go back to the hotel, right? And they want to get like a cheese or a steak sandwich at like 3 a.m. They can't get it. And they go berserk and they start to throw their TVs out the window. It's like they just played to 2,000 people. They've been a daughter. And you can't make me a damn sandwich, yeah. And it was great because I interviewed a guy for a radio show that was did about 15 years ago who was Led Zeppelin's tour manager. And absolutely brilliant. He... when they checked into a hotel, Zeppelin, even if it was after the gig, it was a late check-in or whatever like that, he wouldn't let the band check in, saying, my name's John Bonham, you know, blah, 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 Jimmy Page, the individual. He would go in and get their keys, all of them. And occasionally you get that thing saying, oh, it's Led Zeppelin, we've got 7 rooms booked. And it would be occasionally like, oh, we only seem to have 6 here. Well, instead of John Bonham or something like, who was a bit volatile, to say the best, would be like... Richard, who was their tour manager, would lean across and said, we need a 7th room. You better find one. Very quiet. So there's no kind of craziness in the lobby. Great, you know, interpersonal skills, knowing what you're working with. Because the thing is, I noticed that a lot of the time. And I noticed things that, to my credit, I think, I learned a lot of things because I was curious as well, in as much as to see the ones that have that in them that were going to make it. Because, for instance, I give you the example of 30,000 people. So all of a sudden, you work with them for a long time, you watch them grow, like a U2 or something like that, and they play bigger and bigger and bigger stadiums. And then it's a major tour. And it takes 2 to 3 years for a band at that size to tour the world. And you might find the singer, the guitar, and they're not quite there, you know. Instead, they're like, what's your problem? And things like that. It might be going over and putting your arm around them and say, you okay? You know, because you might have played to 30,000 people, Damon, and been adored, but your wife might had a baby, and you know, and you're going to be on the road for another 2-3 months, and you'd rather be at home having a pizza and watching a movie. So you have to be compassionate. And I always say, I don't want to put a down on things, but I'm not a great fan of music schools or things, because this is not a how to do business. No two bands are alike. No two labels are alike. No two managers are alike. It's not how to do business. You've got a problem with your bathroom, get a plumber. You know, your electrics don't work, get an electrician. This isn't how to do business. And I even went into and said that myself to a course I was going to do on Udemy, because I found a Canadian rapper selling a course that was how to be successful in the music business. And it pissed me off so much. And I was like, you know what I did? I got all my bullshit discs behind me and I put them on the wall. And I sat in front of a chair and I said exactly what I said to you. Let me tell you, this isn't how to do business. And because I've got the verification behind me, they're going to listen. And that is like, I mean, Canada's not really notorious for its white rappers for a start. But to try and con people into things like that. And I did a talk a long time ago And there was a Q&A at the end when I was living in Florida. And there was a guy, and it was very sad because he was a cancer survivor. So there was a certain amount of empathy, you know. And he'd worked a little bit in publishing, but not a high level. And he got up and he said this, and he said, "Let me tell you, if you've got talent, you will make it." And I was like this. I said, "That is so not true, you know, because it takes a lot more than talent. It takes things like interpersonal skills and stuff like that. Because all the topics that I talk about, you know, in my little set list, so to speak, and it's quite exclusive to me because I mean, Branson's busy, you know, Bonner's got a day job. No, nobody really talks about it, you know.
What do you have on your set list?
Well, I have like, I have some, and here we go back to U2. I have a thing called preparing for success. When U2 were 18 and preparing for the school disco, they decided to share all the publishing, which is a pretty good idea because coming from Manchester in England, what the problems were with the Smiths and the Stone Roses, when they exploded and the two people that wrote the song were earning more money than the other two, it's like, well, don't complain about it now. Get your house in order. So the difference between them going multi-platinum and having issues internally, they dealt with it from day one. And if you like know what I know about the band, they have a they're on the same record label that Paul McGinnis had managed them for 35 years and retired. Well, he's perfectly entitled. There's nothing more to do now with U2. So he retired about 8 years ago. Now they're with the whole Live Nation setup and stuff like that. The same crew, the same tour, they had the same tour manager who sadly passed away in an LA hotel a few years ago. But he was still on board for 30 years. And Dennis, who's an Irish guy, was a big Manchester United fan, which is my tip. I always used to go, even when I was left island, I'd stand on the mixing desk and watch the concert. And it was so funny because I interviewed him for one of my radio shows. And he was very, you know, big football fan and things. I was asking him a few questions about this and that. And, you know, there's this, you know, 40,000 people in a football ground. It was the Raymond James Stadium where the Tampa Bay Buccaneers play. And I'm on the mixing desk and I'm talking to him and asking him a few questions. And then all of a sudden the lights go down and they start to walk on stage and he leans over into my mic and he goes, what did he say? He said, time to check the fuel and pump some gas, Tony. And he just goes behind the mixing desk and brings a face. And it's like, whoa. And you know, it's not starstruck. It's like, how cool is this?
Oh,
and you know,
gosh.
I still get chills when I watch them, and I think this was the band that I saw play to 11 people in the pub. I thought they'd do well. You know, they do quite this well. And I thought that about some bands that have failed, but it's not at the end. But I think the thing is that they had an infrastructure of people, and they had a label owner, Chris Blackwell, that didn't stop making that record thinking, well, listen, this is my money. You're not going to make it with a guy who produces ambient records. So he had, but he didn't even think they were that good, but he didn't oversee the guy who signed them and the girl who found them. He left them to it. So he didn't like, you know, go above their heads and say, listen, this is my label, you're not signing them. And I also think to this day that if they'd assigned to a major label or somebody else, they would have been dropped within 2 years because they didn't have any success. But Ireland were £250,000 actually into tour support. And they didn't hassle them for it or anything like that. They just kept supporting them and supporting them. And then there came a situation like down the line where Ireland owed them £1 million in unpaid royalties. And they just said, pay it when you got it. So that loyalty factor as well. And I think the thing is that the other lessons that you mentioned that's the preparing for success. And the other thing is when you think of it is like, and I just mentioned before about the biggest artists are the easiest to work with. And Bowie's a classic example because they know it's about a team of people. And I learned some amazing things about Bowie. I interviewed a guy for my podcast who played. I mean, my first question was, his name was Kevin Armstrong. And I said, Kevin, we're not talking about playing tambourine for a lesser mortal here. We're talking about you playing guitar with David Bowie at Live Aid. And I'm like, looking at the guy like this, you know. And he said, yeah, no. And he told me like the stories and things. But the amazing thing was, just before I interviewed him, and this was great fodder for me, I read an article that members of Bowie went out on tour and some of them interviewed. There's a guy called Mike Garson who played piano with Bowie for the best part of 30 years. And he said this, which is again an incredible business lesson. He said the great thing about David was he didn't micromanage. You know, he said he just left you to it. And the thing is, when I was talking to this guy, Kevin, I said, Kevin, you played guitar with Bowie. I said, you went on stage to 1.4 billion people watching you and a stadium full of fanatical people because the guy that's on stage is a superstar. Did you not play the best guitar you could ever played? He said, Tony, absolutely. He said, the mere fact that David Bowie invited you onto his band, oh my God, am I going to be good? And in my own little way, I was great at the job I did because he didn't interfere with me. He'd asked me what I thought he should do. And that is a great lesson because the thing is, he wants to meet, going back to what I said before, he wants to meet everybody that he works with so that he gets a feel for them, right? He builds a relationship with them. He's never like, you know, micromanaging and coming in and ruling, you know, the way you do things. And he gets the best out of people. And I think that's a real, real asset. So I have that. You know, I have mistakes and opportunities, which I mentioned too.
One thing I like about what you said there too is even with a guy like Bowie asking you questions, being curious, it shows that even he's able to be vulnerable, right? And I think that a lot of what I found is a lot of great leaders realize that they want to surround themselves with the best people. And when they surround themselves with the best people, they need to tap into their strengths. And essentially, that's what Bowie was doing right there.
Yeah. And you do get the complete opposite, which sadly is what happened to my daughter back in the UK. You get somebody come in and then somebody underneath you is actually really good at their job. And I'm not saying it because my daughter, right? And they make life difficult for you. So you kind of have to leave because, you know, you're better at your job than they are at theirs, you know. And she does courses in leadership. And again, I'm not being biased, but she's brilliant, Ali. And she'd been there 17 years. I had a friend who got thrown under the bus by his boss at a business in Orlando. But there comes a time, Damon, where there's nobody left to throw under the bus and you get exposed and you lose your job because you've been found out. But the best people in the company have then gone. And I think the thing is with the fact that, you know, those people I was talking about were able to, you know, retain those relationships and stay in those jobs, there's a credit to the fact that they had the right job with the right people. And Bowie was constantly evolving, you know, because he was the first person to release a record on the internet. You know, he saw the internet coming before any record company. And to this day, it grieves me thinking, I mean, the reason I emigrated 20 years ago, 2004. I had a place in Orlando and the music industry was falling apart around me and I hadn't done anything wrong. But I kind of did my Ziggy Stardust because, you know, nothing lasts forever. Hey, if you're a footballer and your knees go and you're in your late 30s, you're never going to play at that level again. And I'd worked with a high, you know, constant profile of artists, plus emerging artists, loving what I did. I had a staff of 10. I had 6 company cars. You know, in those days, it was £120 a quarter to rent a photocopy that can get from Best Buy for $25 now. So my overhead was 10 grand a month. I was never going to sustain that. And pretentious as it sounded, I wanted to kind of leave my little legacy in place. So I did what Bowie did was I kind of stopped it in Ziggy Stardust and I moved on to the next thing. And I was naive. They call it like entrepreneurial industry. I call it flying by the seat of my pants. I've never known. I had a job all my life that I woke up in the morning, had no clue what would happen. And you know what? I got off on it. I didn't want a 9-to-5. I didn't want anything like that. So the thing is, you know, you would have like maybe a situation where a lead singer had overdosed before a network TV. Don't worry, we'll sort it out. And no need for panic or anything like that. And you know, I grew into, you know, it was really funny because I did an interview where my book came out 2 years ago with it. And the guy was from Manchester. And there's a story about meeting Led Zeppelin when I was 15 and understanding what it was like to meet your heroes, you know. And so the guy had been and bought the book. And the first question he asked me, you do get questions like about Bowie. And he said this to me. He said, what do you think the music industry taught you, Tony, that would have helped you as a 15-year-old meeting Led Zeppelin? And I thought, wow, that's a good question. I said, well, and a lot of time like this, I said, not as much as you think. And he went, really? I said, yeah. I said, when I was 6 or 7, I realized, you know, I didn't want to hang out with this bully on the school playground, this jerk. So I avoided him, you know. And when I was in my teenage years and discovering girls, I had to stand in front of them and ask them out of fear rejection. you know. So, you know, they don't, and again, I'm not dissing education, but I was doing shit like Latin and stuff like that, you know, I was dead Andy, you know, and maths and all those things, you know, they don't teach you interpersonal skills at school. I still say you don't learn how to drive until you pass your test, because generally you're out there with everybody else. So I came from a generation of people that made it up as we went along. There were no defined rules by how you did it. But at the same time, it was like I always say, people didn't play their records before because they liked me. They played them because they respected. They listened to them because they respected me. They knew I had a job to do. My job was to report back to the label, the manager, the artist, and even to stand up in front of them and saying, it's not going to help. And with it, you mentioned Matchbox 20 before, that I learned so much working from their manager. He was amazing, because I get off on things like that. When I'm working with the best, I step up, because you can't be substandard when you're working with people that are great at their jobs, and it brings the best out of you. It's an adrenaline rush. And it's funny, because I started working with him by just sending facts and without getting paid. And then when he came to London, he stayed in Hyde Park in this hotel. He had this suite, and the band were doing the London gig. And I went down to meet him, and I went up to his room. And he looked at me and said, oh, can I get a drink, son? Instead of saying, like, I'll have a glass of water, please. I saw a bottle of Veuve Clicquot. I said, I'll have a glass of that, please, Michael. So he had a glass of champagne. He walked up to me. He said, I was very impressed the way you called me. And he said, and I checked you out. And I went, yeah, and I checked you out. I don't want to work with a manager who's not kind of as great as he made out to be. And I had a great relationship with him because, you know, getting a band that he would phone me, and it was great because that's an 8-hour time difference. So I might have gone to bed. I'd a little bit of a smoke, gone to bed, and midnight, the phone goes, Michael, I'd like a word with you. Oh, good, put him on, you know. And he was coming to me and saying to me, he had this offer to do all these regional press interviews in the UK. Michael wanted to know what you thought of it. And I read through it, and I was just dead honest with him, because there were little things like small publications, and it filled 2 pages of paper. And I said, well, to be honest, Michael, it's not going to make any difference, because they're not big publications. They've not got large readerships and stuff. And I said, but, you know, that's just being honest. Well, he said, thank you so much. He said, because it's going to cost me $60,000 to bring him into the UK. And that's recoupable. We can take him to Germany or Australia where we're selling records. So I've never been frightened of being upfront with people. Not like no swagger or anything, just being totally honest. And now we live in an age of authenticity and stuff and things like that. I always just say to people, if you think I'm the biggest jerk you've ever met, I won't let you down. I'll be just the same next time.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, no, I was actually just listening to Matchbox 20 earlier, a big fan of them. So when you give, there's so many great words of wisdom in there, but when you're giving your presentations or your keynotes, right, with the lessons that you learned, they're transferable to the business world. What are a couple of the aha moments? Like, for instance, after you get done talking, you know, somebody pulls you off the side of the stage and says, hey, Tony, can you talk to me a little bit about that? That really resonated with me.
Everything changed in the pandemic. But one of the great business lessons from the pandemic is resilience, you know, and the fact is, and even on the music side, you would get all these artists that would just sit in their lounge in the living area with an acoustic guitar and play a song and work for like tips and donations. They didn't have the imagination to do something a little bit different, because, and it's interesting because I've been talking to some people who are big on golf, and the golf was like the thing that exploded in the pandemic, because everybody was out in the open, literally, no pun intended, connecting, you know. Now it's like a massive growth area and things. But I think the thing is, with resilience is one thing, like I said, opportunities, mistakes into opportunities, and collaboration. Because if you think of it, like if you remember back in the day, I mean, whoever would have thought of Aerosmith and Run DMC making a record together? It was a massive, it was a great idea, but it was a hell of a chance, you know. And the other thing is that
it was a bold move. It was a very bold move.
But I also think the thing is, because, you know, interpersonal skills is a big thing. And the fact is, I go back to that curiosity thing, and I interviewed a guy called Andy Bird for my podcast, who was the chairman of Walt Disney International. And he worked at a radio station I worked with back in the 80s. I had a show once a week for like 13 years. So even on that side of things, I did over 700 radio shows back in England. So that was a good way of not having a weekend to yourself, because I was on a Saturday night. But the thing is, I was talking to him, and he, you know, his first job, he was living in a place outside Manchester, and he phoned the local radio station, which was a big station. And then ended up asking him to come in and answer phones for this DJ in the evening. And he worked his way up to work with this guy called Chris Evans, who was became a big celebrity in the UK. And when I was talking to him, he said, you know, Tony, he said, right from the start, he said, we go back to this, he always had that curiosity. He said, I was curious about the radio station. I wanted to work in the diamond business, but I had no idea how to go about it. But he did exactly the same as what I said. I don't have a job for the music industry. If I don't get it, I still don't have a job in the music industry. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. So he found the radio station. He got the job. And I met him at a reunion of the radio station, and we were having a few beers, and I got an Uber to go back to where I was staying. And I pulled out his business card, and it was Andy Bird. I knew he'd done well. It was like Andy Bird, MBE, member of the British Empire, closest thing to knighthood, excluding it, really. Chairman Walt Disney International. I thought, wow, I didn't know he'd done that well. But the thing is, he hasn't changed at all. And he said, even when I applied for that job, he said, even as I went through the ranks, through the years, he said, I always had that curiosity where people came to me. I didn't want to know about their college degrees. I wanted to hear their story, you know, and I thought, wow, I love that. Because you get to know somebody and what the potential is. And that job in corporate, like with HR and things, is like an A&R job. You get a demo by a band that have potential, but they're not quite there. So you're matching with the right producer and things like that. Well, I think in business, it's about building a team around people so that all of a sudden these, I don't really want to use the word nobodies, but these people with, like I said, me, I had no experience in the music business, but I had the curiosity factor and the fact that it was the job that I never expected that would never let go. And for you to take that into your world, like even if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a nurse, a doctor, a dentist, you know, I have a lot of friends that worked in different professions. They made it their commitment to work hard to get into that position, go through education or whatever, but once they got it, they would never want to let it go. So instead of just getting a job like I did to pay to buy records and go to gigs, it wasn't ever going to be a career. It's just that instead of living at home and having, you know, the mortgage paid by my parents and the food bought and the clothes, I wanted to make my own, you know, like find what could be a career. Because believe it or not, there was a moment I wanted to be like a lawyer. But like business is like my worst, greatest strength, except the fact that I learned more about business in rock and roll than I ever would learn from a job, if that makes sense.
It does.
You turn it into like, it's almost like a lifestyle, because I think the thing is that I have some really fantastic, and especially since Facebook and stuff like that came around, people I never would have reconnected with are coming back into my world through social media. But that I work with some people who've been lifelong fans that I met in the music industry, and I've worked with some of the most horrible people you would ever imagine. Because another one of the quotes is Hunter S. Thompson, and he said, you know, he wrote for Rolling Stone, he wrote the book on...
Of course.
He's very, you know, he's passed away now, so sadly, but he said, the music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where pimps and thieves run free and good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side.
Ha ha ha. No, he's Hunter S. Thompson. You know, he spent a lot of time out here in San Francisco, super famous. Yeah. Wonderful books.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, yeah, San Francisco. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, but I think the other lessons are what I'm actually going to do now is my first book came out 12 years ago, but it kind of went from lessons learned. It kind of started off with me growing up in the music industry and wanted to play for Man United when I was 14, and then wanted to be a rock star when I was 16, and then growing up when I was 17 and realized I was no good at music and I wasn't going to ever get in playing, you know, major football. So I got like the job and kind of bumbled my way through it, but made it work, and it became my entire career. And even to the extent of, I do feel that I made the right decision coming out. I mean, it wasn't easy to start with, you know, because I thought, hey, they like the English accent, I might get forward commercial or something. Naivety, but never scared or anything, because, you know, life has a habit of throwing things at you, and then all of a sudden you find a way to deal with them. And even now I'm kind of involved with an emerging talent company in the UK, and I had this project about, you know, I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm looking at a Bob Dylan poster, The Times They Are A-Changing, I've had it for 40 years and framed it, you know, and musicians had a voice and they had a place to be heard, you know, like Neil Young, you know, Four Dead in Ohio, the Kent State Murders and stuff.
Do you think that artists have the same impact now or that they did back then? I mean, they have a bigger platform even with social media, right?
They have all that, but everything's changed, Damon. I mean, if you look at the music industry, it took them 40 years to realize there would never be a band as big as the Beatles, you know, and it had all changed. But there were formats that came in. There were cassettes, and there was 8-tracks, and then CD came in, right? And the biggest expense in making a record was recording costs. I mean, nowadays, people make them on computers, right? But in those days, you had to book a studio at like $250 an hour. You had a tape operator, an engineer, and a producer, right? And that's why you got an advance from a record company, and then you get something out. And if it doesn't happen, it's a tax loss for the label. But the other thing is, if it does, then that's recoupable. So you can have $250,000 like U2 put into them. And then if it doesn't work, they're a write-off. But you're a band that, you know, have been dropped. It's hard to get back to another record company. And then CD came in, right? And all these people that had bought the records like in their teens and stuff, we talk about the bands you were talking about, the progressive rocks, the Zeppelins, all that and everything. But they went to the artists and asked them to take a reduced royalty for a record that had already been made, right? Because it was just another format. And they were coining it in. And then because of the arrogance in it, there's when, you know, Napster came along, much in the same way as the pirates back in England. It was like when all of a sudden I learned, that's where I heard Led Zeppelin and Tyrannosaurus Rex first time. The way to get rid of them was just close them down, right? And then the BBC Radio came in and started playing the records of these other people out with no licenses were playing out in the middle of the sea. But it was where I grew up. You used to listen under your pillow when you went to bed, and it's great music and it's great DJs. And then, like, you know, when Napster came and went, and that's why I say I worked for a company called Magic Leap, where the guy was a rock star in technology. He was a co-founder of a company called Mako, which was robotic surgery. They would go into people's knees on the other side of the world and repair them, right? So he was a rock star in tech, but he knew he wouldn't get anywhere with, you know, directly getting through to record companies. If he was around running a record company or Bowie, when Napster came along, instead of closing them down, he would have said, let's have lunch and sit down and talk about it and find a way to make it work. And then the rest is history, because Steve Jobs came in with an idea to sell songs instead of albums. And that was no good to the industry because they made their money on albums. People would have to buy an album if they liked two songs on it because they'd heard the singles on the radio. And it was the greed factor. And I watched a program just the other night on, it was on Tower Records, and it was amazing that the opening caption read, and it was called, I can't remember what it was called. But the opening graphic that came across, he said in 1999, Tower Records turnover was $1 billion.
Wow.
5 years later, they filed for bankruptcy. It was like, whoa. And it had Elton John on, and it had Springsteen on. And it said like, Elton John said, I spend more money in Tower Records than I spent anywhere. And Springsteen said, every time I was on the road, I was always going to Tower Records. And the people behind the shop counter, Dave Grohl from Nirvana, and, you know,
Foo Fighters.
Worked at Tower Records. Foo Fighters, yeah, worked at Tower Records.
So did Slash, Guns N' Roses, or Axl, yeah.
Exactly. But the thing is, they also had David Geffen on, who signed all those artists, the Eagles, Joni Mitchell, and everything back in the day. And he was talking about, you know, Tower Records. He said, the thing is that, you know, the thing that happened in the industry was, you know, Tower Records started opening records all over the world and this and that. And it was where everybody who was into music bought their records. And then all of a sudden, you know, then CDs came along and they were selling them for like $16. And across the road, Walmart and Best Buy were selling for like cost, like $10. So the record stores were like forced out of business because they just became a commodity. You could buy a pair of shoes, you could buy a shirt, you could buy a record, you could buy, you know, gardening stuff and things. And it's really sad to see it happen. But I look back on my own career and I was really fortunate because I learned from the music people. I learned from people like Chris Blackwell and Alma Dirtigan and Jerry Moss and Herb Alpert, the kind of people who were signing acts that they would have had in the record collection and thinking the same way that my own little way with my storytelling. Well, if I enjoy the stories, why won't others? Well, they're thinking, well, if I buy this record, why won't other people? So they invest in them and they allow them to grow. I mean, Bob Marley, for instance. Bob Marley had been making records in Jamaica for like next to nothing. They'd pay for the record and then they'd never see another cent. There were never any royalties. So he'd been ripped off all his life and he was fierce as a lion. And Bob and Chris Blackwell, who's a white Jamaican, you know, is, well, he was the reason for my Moments That Rock, because I had this idea of walking along the beach in St. Pete. And I, you know, it was a senior moment. I thought, I met some amazing people along the way. Who am I to take those stories to the grave? And I it started as three Moments That Rock. And I was going to sit in front of people that I'd worked with over the years and ask them to share three moments, three pivotal moments that helped shape who they are today. And here's a classic example. Chris Blackwell lived in Goldeneye in the Bahamas, right? Goldeneye, he bought it off the Bob Marley estate. Bob Marley bought it off Cerine Fleming. Cerine Fleming dated Chris Blackwell's mother. Could you imagine going to Goldeneye and having Chris Blackwell, who's 85, telling you the story about the first time he met Bob Marley in the same place Cerine Fleming wrote every James Bond book? You can't make shit like that up.
You can't make stuff like that up.
It's all storytelling. It's like, here, you're giving me a vehicle and giving me a lot of time to kind of exude what came and helped me. Listen, I'm not sitting here, you know, I have to put food on the table like everybody else. But I say to people, if I'd have picked up, I always stuck to my roots. I mean, when a record company wanted me to be head of promotion at Island at 28, you know, I had a three-year-old and my wife was pregnant. I wasn't going to go to London and live in a bedsit to get a job. I said, no, I'll do it from where I am. They said, what do you mean? You have to move to London. I said, I don't have to do anything. And I remember looking out the window, my little girl was playing in the garden with her mates. And I created regional promotion based, guess what? And I said to him, why would I travel 200 miles north, south, to travel 400 miles to do my job? If you look at a map, Manchester's right in the middle of the country. It made a lot of sense to me, not to anybody else, because, whoa, London or nothing. No. So I created, you know, my own company. I never employed anybody that had worked for a record company. I just employed people who thought I had that certain something, right? And I empowered them. I gave them one piece of advice. Whatever you screw up on, I'll pull you out of. So instead of threatening them with their jobs, you know, if you don't get it played, you're out of work, I left them to it. So, I had two people left to start their own promotion company. I had a guy who was working in a video shop that got introduced to my ex-lodger, who was a DJ, who ended up being a national DJ the BBC and is still on there 25 years later. I had some guy that set up a press company and my intern went on to manage Coldplay. And not one of those people had worked for a record company. But I just, then that's what I talk about artist development and you know, nurturing talent. Artist development doesn't begin and end. Emerging talent doesn't begin and end with artists. It's on every level. And I feel that, and I've experience the good and the bad in the business world, you know, because you get curious about things like that. And I've seen people grow from nothing into being hugely successful, but it's always a certain type of people who think, I can do this. And then all they do is don't talk about it. They get on and do with it. And then you get the other extreme where some guy who's wealthy goes to bed and he thinks about making more money. You know, his wife's bored and she's probably going out to spend the credit card and screwing the gardener, you know, because all they want to do is make more and more money and she's bored senseless. But the thing is, you know, whatever line of business, I like people that are self-made. You know, I'm not dissing education, but I think you learn so much more by the people around you. And I always said this, and I wrote about it in my book as well, Dave, and I was saying things like, nothing I've ever achieved in my career has been down to me. It's been down to a team of people. And that's the my greatest asset, if you like, was just a gut feeling about, I think this person could work and stuff. And then even if you're in a hairdresser and you're really good, you leave to open your own salon. And there's no way I expected people to stay forever. But I didn't, like I say, and when this girl ended up managing Coldplay, she phoned me from Cardiff University. She just graduated and she said, I'm coming to Manchester and people have told me I should come and work for you. I said, well, that's very flattering, but there's no room at the inn, meaning we had no vacancies. So she said, well, I'm coming up anyway. Can we get together and have a drink? Yeah, we can have a drink, you know. So we go and have a drink. And she went on a beer and she says, I'll come work for you for nothing. I said, well, I can't say no to that. I said, let me tell you. I said, you'll be making cups of coffee. But guess what? I make cups of coffee as well. Meaning I would never employ anybody to do something that I wouldn't do.
Very important.
Listen, a lot of people, you know, careers have a bit to do with us, you know, so we can't have you going out without an experience. I can put you in the back of the car when somebody's taken an artist out on a promotional tour, and then after 6 months, I ended up paying her. And then she went to work with a band called Happy Mondays and ended up working a decade or so with Coldplay. Then she had kids and got on with a grown-up life and things. But she got that job by saying to me, and I had another incident when I did a talk at a university in Orlando. A girl came up to me and gave me a tape at the end of my talk and said, oh, can I give you this? I've got a label with my partner, you know. And she gave it me. And then, you know, I don't know if she sent me, you know, I just said, oh, nice to meet you. I've listened to your tape, you know, and we got talking. And then I said, if you're ever over here, you know, give me a shout, you know, we'll get together. And I said, and then all of a sudden, you know, she obviously made an excuse to come over. So she came up with a partner. And I said to her, like, I said, well, what made you come up and give me a tape? She said, well, I was really nervous. I said, why? She said, well, you've worked with all these people, these famous people. Why would you want to talk to me? And it was a discovery moment for me in thinking, wow, would you think that? And I leaned over, I said, listen, I'm not bragging, but if I was a lawyer, I might be $250 an hour. You know, I've been there and done it over the years. I said, but you know, all right, you picked up the tab tonight. I had a burger and some fries and a beer. You know, I said, and you paid for dinner and everything. But, you know, this is down to you, not down to me. It's you coming up and having the courage to introduce yourself and tell me what you're doing. And now all of a sudden you've got a guy who has got experience to tell you what he thinks. And they had an hour and a half of my time. We sat down, we talked about the label and things. But bravo to her for having the courage to do it. Instead of that kind of like nervousness, you know. And like I say, I'm no better. In my own David Bowie way, I'm no better than anybody or worse than anybody else. I'm just myself. And I speak my mind and nothing frightens me in, you know, well, I mean, maybe if we looked at the world, frightens me, but there's nothing I can do about that. But when it comes to like, you know, I've also gained a lot of experience in age, in as much as, like I said, I don't think the gratitude sets in until the roller coaster ends, but I'm much more vigilant about the company I keep. Like when I left Florida, it was like, I didn't put it on Facebook or anything. I just quietly left, right? And it's like, there were people that I don't need. So it's good luck with the rest of your life, but you're not part of mine. So I'm very selective now in having people around me like that Michael Lippmann experience in the late 90s where they'll bring the best out of me. And I have people in my life now that when I honestly feel I could be entering the most exciting part of my career because I'm working with people I want to work with and I don't have an overhead. It's little old me sat here.
It's you. No, Tony, all those are so many great things there. You know, what I love saying is surround yourself with great people. Let them know, go out, take chances. And if things fall apart, you'll get their back. You'll get there for them. The story about the woman who had the courage to come up and say something to you, you know, your gut feeling around you too and seeing other things and resilience over the pandemic. And also, you know, how important storytelling is, right? So as we wrap up here, you have one very important story that you're working on coming up. Can you share a little bit with the audience around what you're doing with the Rock the World to Peace project?
Yeah, well, what happened was a journalist from France who I got to know through LinkedIn approached me and she had this idea. Because basically, you know, without getting into what's happening, we're in the middle of a, you know, election and things. There's a war. We're on the verge of World War III. There's conspiracy theories. It's not the world I grew up in. You know, I don't worry about me. I worry about my kids and stuff. But we've got this platform, which is basically we're going to bring artists in a mini Live Aid way to do 10 minutes and perform two songs. And it's called Unbound, which means it can be sat in your living room on your stool, you know, playing an acoustic song. It can be somebody filming you from a stage. And we just ask them to support the cause. So at the beginning of it, it's like we're proud to be associated with Rock the World to Peace. Our band's called such and such, and this is a song called this. And then they do another number. And at the end, it's kind of a fist bump or something. Remember, Rock the World to Peace. So we're trying to, there's no politics, there's no religion, there's no wars, there's nothing like that. It's just bringing peace and harmony for musicians to come together that can actually, you know, we have our own website as we speak being built, and they have a showcase. So instead of putting your music on YouTube and hoping, apart from friends and family, people stumble on it, because there's everything on YouTube, we showcase it and we'll work with them. But we want, it has to be exclusive to us. We have a love dove in the background. They can use that as a backdrop. And they can't put it on their social media platform. They can point them to us, because then all those people will find other artists that they never would have found otherwise. But they're supporting the cause, and they're getting the visibility through us, but they're also like pointing people in our direction. And it's going to be great, because at the end of the day, we want to create an event like a Live Aid. Listen, we live in a different time, Damon, but it might not be a Wembley Stadium gig that goes over on satellite and Phil Collins flies on Concorde. I mean, I'm always a great believer in from small acorns, you know, a natural emerging talent in a way that you can see, even to the extent of the artist that withers early, we can bring new material in, put it on the site, and the old material comes off. So we help them develop their career, which gives them an excitement of something outside of their social media channels. It's really hard for emerging talent now, because radio doesn't break records like it used to. And there's 110,000 songs a day that get loaded to Spotify.
Well, Tony, that's amazing. You have an amazing story. I want to give a little shout out to our mutual friend who we introduced us to each other, Brad Zolas. You know,
thank you, Brad. Yeah.
Thank you, Brad, from Awakened Nation. This has been amazing. I mean, from somebody who, you know, loves music and all the stories you told and how you tied it back to rock and roll, I really, really appreciate it, Tony. Can you share with our audience, where can they connect with you at?
Well, my website is tonymichaelidis.com. I mean, if you Google me, my podcast will come up, or if you Google Moments That Rock, and you can go and do your background check, because I don't need to blabber on about myself, go and check it out type thing.
Or your Wikipedia page.
Well, my Wikipedia page as well. And I mean, that was another thing that I'm grateful for. When I emigrated, I got an alien of extraordinary ability, which was the service to the music and arts. And that's awarded to a small percentage of people in the government website that reached the pinnacle of success in the field of endeavor. So it's a great endorsement, you know, to have, thinking that you're appreciated for what you did. But the thing is, I don't want to go and do what I did. I want to be like in a different position now, with connecting, like with yourself. When we connected, we spoke for an hour or so on the phone. There was a connection. So, and I'm not like begging you, but it made sense to do this, Brad. You know,
of course.
Just call you Brad.
That's all right.
The fact is, you know, just before we finish, is the fact that Brad thought we'd get on, and we do get on. But the thing is,
we're friends now.
I'm speaking to a bunch of people who would never have discovered me, right? So yeah, if you Google me, there is my book's available on my website, signed copies and stuff. And I have a book me page and stuff. But I really like going out and telling stories and having people looking at things from a different angle. Because with what you were doing is, I don't want to preach to the converted. I don't want to go on a David Bowie fan site and talk about David Bowie. There's millions of books on him. There's millions of this. But I want to bring people that, you know, can have a little access all areas pass into what it is about these artists. And there's plenty more subject matters. I mean, you know, because for a lot of people, like I said before, that are running corporate America, you two have always been famous. So they don't relate to a fact when they were nothing. I mean, and there's nothing like music to take you back to a time and a place. And my last line, I promise, is the opening line of my talks are like, the best part of the journey is the people you meet along the way. And the people I met along the way were the rock stars, who just might be the very same ones that you grew up listening to. And you take people, it's kind of not a tacky seduction, but you take them back. I mean, who might have met their future wife at a David Bowie or a U2 gig? There's nothing like music to take you back to a time and a place, and invariably with a person. I don't care if you're into sport or anything like that. You don't remember a touchdown. Music, you know, those that are old enough to remember, you know, they knew where they were doing when John Lennon got killed, you know, and stuff like that. And that's not being nerdy. That's just being, you know, I'm passionate about and grateful that I made my hobby into a job and grew from that as a person and you know, the people I met.
And I'm honored to be one of them. And so thank you, Tony. thank you so much for sharing your story with our audience today. And for all you listeners out there, please do me a favor, rate and subscribe to our channel. Please check out Tony's work. And there's so many great things we talked about today that can relate both to what he learned from rock stars in your entrepreneurial journey or whatever you're doing. So until next time, everybody, like Tony said many times today, stay curious and keep growing. Have a great day. Goodbye.